Good morning. Before we proceed with the first argument this morning, I think it's appropriate to note that this is our first oral argument, which is access to the public over the Internet. We hope that this provides the public with an opportunity to further inform itself on how this court resolves legal disputes that come before it. For future use, the public is invited to consult our homepage to learn the names of our cases for upcoming terms. These will be posted approximately 30 days in advance of the term. The court would also like to thank South Dakota Public Radio for its assistance throughout the process of putting this Internet project together. Without their extensive assistance, we would not be on the air today. First case for oral argument this morning is Sopko versus CNR Transfer. Court should note that Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable William Sirska, a circuit judge from the Second Circuit in Sioux Falls, to sit in his place. For the appellant, we have Mr. Eric Schulte, attorney from Sioux Falls, and also for the appellee, we have Mr. Dean Acer, an attorney from Sioux Falls. The court would also note that we were able to coax one of our former justices out of retirement. Justice Amundson is also serving for this term of court. As Justice Designate Judith Meyer-Henry will not be sworn in until Friday after the term is completed. With that, Mr. Schulte, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. As the court indicated, my name is Eric Schulte, and I represent appellants CNR Transfer Company and Home Insurance Company in this matter. Before addressing the facts of this particular case and the legal arguments presented, there is a point I believe I should make with the court. As I reviewed my materials in preparation for this argument, I noted that one of the arguments I have advanced in my brief concerning Mr. Nacer's client's attempt to receive death benefits pursuant to SDCL 62-4-12 was not accurate. I have advanced the argument that the legislature amended the death benefit statute in 1919 to determine dependency status at the time of death versus at the time of injury. And I subsequently argued that that amendment was then rescinded in 1939 by the legislature, and that the legislature at that time changed the determination of dependency status back to the time of injury. In reviewing my materials, I believe that is an error, and I believe that consistently throughout South Dakota law, death benefits have been determined at has been determined at the time of injury. I apologize to the court for any confusion this may have caused, and I also apologize to counsel for that.
Are you saying at time of injury or time of death?
Time of injury, Your Honor. I believe that the death benefit statutes codified by the legislature have consistently determined dependency status at the time of injury, which will be a critical point in addressing the arguments advanced by the parties in this case. Again, I believe there was a change in the law. In reviewing my materials, I do not believe that that is accurate, that there was not a change in the law. The law has been consistent, that dependency status is determined at the time of injury and not at the time of a claimant's death. Having said that, I will briefly address the facts of this case. This matter arises out of a work-related injury sustained by a gentleman named Jeffrey Sopko back in August of 1974, when Mr. Sopko was inflating a tire in the course of his business, which exploded, causing him to sustain injury to his head and also to break his arm. Between the period of 1974 through 1977, the parties have stipulated that Mr. Sopko received all of the benefits he was due and entitled to receive for that period of time. Notably, at the time of Mr. Sopko's injury in 1974, he was not married to appellee Kay Sopko, who was a party in this action, and also Mr. Joshua Sopko was not born at that time. Mr. Joshua Sopko was not born until 1983. Between the period of 1974 to 1977, Mr. Sopko worked, but unfortunately in 1979, he contracted spinal meningitis and developed a seizure condition. Ultimately, in 1979, a petition for benefits was filed with the Department of Labor, which was resolved by a settlement agreement reached by the parties in 1981. Following reaching that settlement agreement, Mr. Sopko continued to work. In 1992, he underwent a surgical procedure for a lobectomy. And in the course of that procedure, scar tissue was determined, which was noticed, which was caused ultimately by the 1974 injury. And it was determined at that time that this scar tissue was causing the seizure condition that Mr. Sopko was experiencing.
And that's what we said in a case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was the case where we said that there was a new condition, and so he's entitled to benefits. That was back in what year was that?
That was decided, Your Honor.
In 98.
Yes, Your Honor, in 1998. At Sopko 1, this court held that pursuant to SDCL 62-7-33, that Mr. Sopko was entitled to reopen his claim for benefits based upon a change of condition. Since that time, with the case being reopened, the parties have stipulated that Mr. Sopko received the payment of all of his medical expenses that were incurred due to his condition, and he has also received, with interest, disability benefits at the rate of $92 per week for the time period between 1993, June 10th of 1993, through 1999, when Mr. Sopko unfortunately passed away.
Was his death related to his work disabilities?
Yes, Your Honor. That has been also stipulated by the parties that it was connected to the 1974 injury.
So if he were still living today and lived for another 20 years, he would continue to receive benefits until his death, wouldn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
And, of course, the employer or the insurance company were on that risk forever until his death.
Yes, Your Honor. When it was decided that it was determined that the seizure condition and the change in Mr. Sopko's condition to permanent and total disability in 1993 was in fact connected to the 1974 injury, I do agree with that. The issues presented for the court today, however, are twofold. The first of which being, what compensation rate is Mr. Sopko entitled to receive for the period between 1993, when he became permanently and totally disabled on June 10th, through the date of his death on 1999? And the second issue to be addressed is whether the appellees, Kay Sopko and Joshua Sopko, are entitled to receive death benefits pursuant to SDCL 62-4-12. The Department of Labor ruled in the favor of the employer and insurer on both issues, ruling that the compensation rate Mr. Sopko was entitled to receive between 1993 through 1999 was governed by the law in effect at the time of Mr. Sopko's injury in 1974. In addition, the department ruled that because Mrs. Sopko was not married to Mr. Sopko at the time of injury in 1974, and because Joshua Sopko was not born at that time, and in fact not born until 1983, they were not dependents at the time of injury. And interpreting the statute in effect in 1974 at the time of injury, 62-4-12, the department determined that they were not able to receive benefits. Now, turning, when that was appealed by Mr. Nacer to the circuit court, Judge Anderson reversed the Department of Labor on both issues and, in effect, held that the compensation rate, in effect, on July 1st of 1993 was the compensation rate that Mr. Sopko should have received during that window between 1993 and 1999.
Why does the claim on the compensation issue come in this late? Wouldn't it have been more appropriately resolved in 1993 when it first comes up?
Your Honor, it's coming in at this time, I would say, probably due to a variety of reasons. There have been negotiations and a petition filed by Mr. Nacer in 1994. And frankly, in 1994, when the petition was filed to reopen based upon a change of condition, that was resisted by the employer and insurer. And ultimately, when this court ruled in 1998 that, in fact, a change of condition had occurred, that he could reopen, the parties attempted to work out the dispute as far as what benefits were due and owing. And in accordance with that, Your Honor, the employer and insurer has paid a compensation rate of $92 per week, which is consistent with what was paid during the 1980 settlement agreement. And that was paid for the period between 1993 to 1999. So I believe some of the delay has to do with the fact that the petition was filed and resisted, and ultimately this court ruled in 1998.
Are the death benefits increased by the number of dependents, or are the death benefits the same based on his prior earnings under the law?
Assuming that the death benefits would apply,
right,
Your Honor, I believe that you would have to look at the people that Mr. Sopko was under a duty to support at the time the death benefits would apply. So I believe it depends on the number of beneficiaries, Your Honor.
So if he had gone out and adopted 100 children in the course of the time prior to his death, actually that could have increased the benefits payable by the insurance company and the employer?
That would assume the hypothetical that it would apply, Your Honor, I believe.
I realize that, but I mean, under the law, under the amount of benefits payable, it depends on the number of dependents.
I believe it does, but there are certain maximums or minimums, I believe, worked into the statute, Your Honor, but it can increase.
If they're children, it pays until they reach the age of majority.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And Mr. Joshua Sopko has, in fact, reached the age of majority at this time. But the key argument that I wish to stress in concern or in regard to the death benefit statute is that the statute as it existed in 1974 articulated that you define dependency status as of the time of the injury. In this particular case, Mr.
Sopko... Does the statute read the same today?
It's not identical today, Your Honor. It has been changed. Today's version of the statute, I believe it comes out to the same result. Today's version of the statute looks to SDCL 62-4-3, which is the compensation rate statute, to determine what benefits apply. And I believe if you look at the compensation rate statute, that also focuses in on the time of injury as well. So I don't believe it's entirely the same today, Your Honor.
But it doesn't explicitly state what you said back in 79, as it was, does it?
It is not. I believe that's correct, Your Honor. It's not exactly the same. But in emphasizing that, I believe...
Well, let me ask you this. When you look at what the legislature does, if they take out the explicit provision that is determined as of the date of death, or injury, I mean.
Yes,
okay. And then they don't put it in later on. What is it? I mean, when you're interpreting statutes, they must have meant that before, so they changed it. That change has to be for some reason, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that.
I think that's based pretty, even for an old fellow like me, hornbook statutory interpretation. So what was the change for then?
Post-1974?
Yeah.
Your Honor, I get my reading of the statute, again, is that it still defines dependency status at the time of injury.
And so now we're under dependency status at the time of injury.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, I do. And as far as what the change is for, Your Honor, I guess I can only speculate, and I'm not certain as I stand here today before the court. But I would like to emphasize that in examining the death benefit argument advanced by Mr. Nacer in this case, it is a fundamental cornerstone of workers' compensation law that the law in effect at the time of injury controls the party's rights. And in this particular case, if you examine SDCL 62-4-12, I believe the only reading from that statute is that you look at ultimately who a dependent was at the time of injury. And at the time of this particular injury, as the Department of Labor found, Mrs. Sopko was not a dependent, and Mr. Joshua Sopko had not been born at that time. And I believe the Department of Labor correctly ruled that in fact death benefits were not warranted under the statute.
Well, now, whenever a trial court reverses a department who said that he has to come forth with reasons, you know, and he usually sets that forth in his decision or in his findings, And he says that the department erred.
Yes, sir.
And the trial judge did it. Okay, now tell me what the trial court did. You're saying was wrong.
Your Honor.
And why is it? What did the trial court rely on that you say doesn't carry the day?
Your Honor, the trial court, I believe, made a number of significant errors, with all due respect, that I believe are not consistent with the history of the death penalty statute or workers' compensation law in general. Initially, the trial court determined that on July 1st of 1993, Mr. Sopko sustained a new injury, a completely separate and new injury that allowed him to have new vested rights and benefits accruing at that date in July 1st of 1993. And based upon that, the trial court ruled that because of this new injury, that Kay Sopko and Joshua Sopko were entitled to receive benefits at the
company. What was the new injury?
There was no new injury, Your Honor. That's what we take issue with in this particular case.
I thought in the first case we decided dealt with that it was an unforeseen condition that resulted from the injury in 79. Isn't that what happened there?
Yes, Your Honor.
We didn't say a new injury then.
You did not. Okay. And the arguments that we have advanced in our brief, Your Honor, would be that the trial court is precluded from making this finding based upon the law of the case. The law of the case in this particular matter, which this court ruled in 1998, indicates that Mr. Sopko experienced a change of condition allowing him to reopen his petition. There was no discussion about a new injury. Yeah, that's the cornerstone of the trial court's ruling. In addition to that, this particular case has been decided on a stipulation of facts, which have been presented in the court for its review. In the stipulation of facts, the parties have agreed that there was a change of condition allowing Mr. Sopko to reopen his case.
So there's no evidentiary deference due the department in this case. We look at the whole thing de novo.
As far as I believe, Your Honor, for the questions of law you do, as far as the factual issues are concerned, I believe it's a clearly erroneous standard.
But it's stipulated. There can't be any clearly erroneous anything, can there?
I believe, Your Honor, that in this case, the trial court, circuit court, made factual findings outside of the bounds of the stipulated facts. And I guess...
What were they and how did they affect the decision then?
They affected the decision because the trial court ruled that there was a new compensable event on July 1st of 1993, which was not even the date that the party stipulated on that Mr. Sopko became permanently and totally disabled.
Well, when you say, excuse me, I interrupted you. I just had to ask, there's a new event. What event are you talking about? Or was there presented to the trial court? Or what does the evidence show as a new event?
I believe that there is no new event, Your Honor. I believe the parties...
Well, let me ask you this. Was there medical testimony presented at this date of the proceeding where it showed that the doctor had reviewed this or, again, diagnosed, went through a complete workup, that there was something new there? Or what are we talking about?
This was purely on a stipulation of facts, Your Honor, which was presented to both the department and on appeal to the circuit court, where the parties stipulated that it was... Indeed, because of the original 1974 injury, that Mr. Sopko became permanently and totally disabled in 1993. But there was never any discussion as far as a new injury occurring in 1993. And that's, in fact, what the trial court found in this matter. And the reason why that finding is important is because both on, as my time is running short, I'll summarize this on both of our arguments to this court. On both the issue, as far as the increased compensation rate is concerned, and both on the payment of death benefits pursuant to our state statute, the circuit court had to find that there was a new injury in July of 1993 in order to vest the parties with new rights occurring at that time, in 1993. Based upon that, the trial court found that Mr. Joshua Sopko and Mrs. Kay Sopko were entitled to a compensation rate existing on July 1st of 1993 for death benefits, also for their claim for permanent total disability benefits. And we're simply contending, Your Honor, that the law of the case precludes that position because there are no facts in the record indicating that there was a new injury in 1993.
The trial court used the date of July 1st, and then the actual date that was agreed was June 10th of the same year.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's simply, in your view, a typographical error, though. It doesn't make any difference for our holding, does it?
I would say that normally that would not be a minor point, but I emphasize that in my brief, Your Honor, because Mr. Nacer has argued in his brief to this court that amendments which occurred on July 1st of 1993 to SDCL 62-7-33 and other amendments are applicable, I presume, to this claim. And the only reason why I raised the three-week discrepancy is because if the law in effect at the time of injury truly controls, and Mr. Sopko became disabled on June 10th of 1993, there is no conceivable way that you can benefit from these amendments that Mr. Nacer argues to this court in his brief. Since I only have a minute and 20 left in my time, I would like to argue to this court now the first major issue presented, which is whether the SOPCOs are entitled to receive an increased compensation rate between 1993, when the permanent and total disability began, until 1999. In order to reach this ruling, the trial court determined that pursuant to SDCL 62-733, the change of condition statute, pursuant to that statute, a new compensation rate was warranted under the law. That because a change of condition occurred in 1993, you are entitled to a compensation rate existing in 1993. And the employer and insurer respectfully urge this court to examine the statutes in effect at the time of injury and the case law. In Salmon versus Denhart Elevators in 1948, which this court recently quoted in Homestake Mining versus the South Dakota Subsequent Injury Fund in 2002, this court has explicitly said that the rights of the parties vest at the time of injury, and that to change rates at a later time violates the obligation of contracts and is not permissible. I would simply urge the court to examine the precedent and case law that is established in this area, and I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you.
Mr. Nacer, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Excuse me.
You can take some water. Okay, you got water. That's fine.
If it pleases the court and counsel, the rights of the parties are fixed in workers' compensation at the time of the injury. The compensation rate for that injury is established at that time. This is the normal rule. What happens to this court-made rule and how it is to be interpreted in light of statutes which existed at the time of the initial injury, and which statutes specify clearly that the rights and obligations of the parties are not fixed when certain conditions occur, is what we're dealing with here today. These conditions, once they occur, justify and in fact require, according to the legislature, that the law be flexible in order to avoid injustice. All injuries are presumptively
treated. Let me ask you this. Let's say that I have an injury in 79 and I have no change of anything. I'm locked into 79, right?
That's too broad a question.
Or anything like that in there, right?
That's too broad a question, Your Honor.
Well, I asked it, and if you think it's too broad, ask me, does the 79 stay there in place?
The 79 rate would stay there as long as we're dealing with that injury.
Well, that's what I just said. I didn't think it was that broad.
Yeah, it is,
no
though.
Change. No unforeseen condition.
No unforeseen change. No invocation of SDC.
So what you're saying, when there's an unforeseen condition that you didn't foresee at the time in 79, then when you get to that point, you're saying that establishes a new time when you determine what the level of benefits is?
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that establishes jurisdiction in the department to see if the condition of the employee, according to the statute, justifies adjusting any payment, including increasing it or awarding it anew. That's what SDCL 62733 does. All injuries are going to be treated the same until maximum medical improvement and for all benefits related to the injury through the time of maximum medical improvement. And even after that, if the benefit is based on the injury that we're talking about initially. Once you invoke SDCL 62733, you're not dealing with just that injury anymore. You're dealing with a whole new set of facts not contemplated at the time of the original injury. That's why we have a flexible statutory scheme.
But there's no new injury.
No new accident. New injury? It's not the same injury. The injury he had in 1974, Your Honor, didn't disable him totally. He went back to work and worked for 20 years. He went back to work and built his earning capacity from a $72 comp rate to $31,900 a year.
Is it really a new injury or a new condition?
Condition, injury, I don't know how you separate those two.
Well, to me, an injury is when you get hurt.
An injury, he was hurt worse in 1993 by the sequela from this injury. That's correct. And it's new and different. The case law that we've cited all over.
Well, that's why you reopen it.
Yes. The case law that, and the reopening doesn't address this issue. This is a subsequent issue that must be addressed when you reopen. And not every case that's going to be reopened, the department is going to require the department to find that a new comp rate is justifiable. It's their discretion we're seeking to invoke. They refused to invoke it, and that's an abuse of discretion. And so all I'm saying is we need to go back before the department, have them look at the facts of this case, and see whether or not this comp rate is supposed to be adjusted. $72 a week is the actual rate. Now, admittedly, they paid us past benefits based on $92 a week because that's what the 1979 agreement, or 81 agreement, actually, for the 79 injury said. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not so concerned about that $20 and whether raising it from 72 to 92 in that agreement buttresses our position. We think they knew they had to raise the comp rate because it was a new insult to the body, a new worsened disability that was not part of this temporary injury. The case law we've cited all across the country is based on the time of injury rule that we use here, all of it. And the results that they've reached are varied based upon the mechanisms built into their statutory schemes to take into account the necessity of avoiding injustice at times like the one we're dealing with here, of having a built-in flexibility. Some of them were purely cost-of-living increases from day one. Some of them were administrative reviews. Some of them had schedules built in where you automatically increase the benefits. We don't have that. We don't have those things built in. We have SDCL 62733. That's the ultimate jurisdiction of the department.
And counsel has mentioned the Homestake decision.
Yes.
And says that we said in there that we aren't going to do anything that violates the contract.
The time of injury. Yes.
Does that apply to this case, do you think?
Yes, it does, favorably to us.
How?
The reason is that you recognized a subsequent injury, the same injury, as being different than the first injury. You recognized that, and you awarded the benefits for the increase in that injury under the subsequent injury fund. It's not on point. But the fact of the matter is we've treated this. This is not entirely new to our jurisprudence. We simply have not encountered until today a factual case that is like this one, that where it is wrong not to adjust the rights of the parties based on the magnitude of this change. If the law is simply a little hole that we're trying to carve the injuries down to fit it all through, every single one of them, without regard to the magnitude of the loss or when it occurs, or the misfortune of a person having a small temporary injury early on, getting locked into a small comp rate, and then the magnitude of the injury befalling him later, the injustice of that is obvious. And so the law gives us 62733 in order to adjust that.
Is there any evidentiary deference due to the decision of the department here?
I'm sorry.
Is there any evidentiary deference due to the department?
No. No, it's stipulated facts.
So you don't agree with counsel's rendition?
Right.
You're inviting us to look at it de novo?
Yes.
And obviously you would disagree with counsel that the circuit court then erred?
I, of course, disagree with that.
Can we pause for just a minute?
And yes, clear up this discrepancy about these dates. The court mentioned July 1st, but apparently you both stipulated June 10th is the date. And then the counsel now suggests that you attach some legal significance to the July 1st date. What's your response?
I did not attach the significance that Mr. Schulte believes I attached.
I have not claimed that the July 1, 1993 changes are binding on this injury. I'm claiming that they are evidence of the clarification of the law throughout. The June 10th date is the one we stipulated to. The July 1, 1993 laws do not bind that.
So then if you prevail, you're saying the benefits that your client would be entitled to would be what would be applicable or under the law on June 10th?
That's correct.
Not on any increase on, you aren't trying to get an increase as of July 1 or anything like that?
No. No.
You're just saying that the July 1st amendment support the theory of your case.
They support the theory.
Logic. That's right. We had bifurcated this case, Your Honor, with damages. That was the answer to the question
you asked Mr. Schulte early on. That's why we're dealing with just damages today.
Why they weren't addressed in 93?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And the thing, Mr. Schulte wasn't involved in that. Was.
All right.
This case, he became totally, in fact, disabled on June 10. His earnings went through, I think it was July something, July 1, 2, 3, something. It doesn't matter. We stipulated that the in fact disability was July 10 or June 10.
He had no other employers or subsequent injuries after that. But he didn't keep working for SOPCO, though.
No working. He was totally disabled after that point in time. He developed a seizure condition based on that scar tissue that was so severe that it killed him in June 5 of 1999.
And that's not a dispute.
None of it is. Those are all stipulated facts. The trial court found that, not the trial court, the circuit court, found that the claimant's 1993 condition, this is finding of fact 7, and the claimant's death in 99 are causally connected to the 74 initial injury, but weren't part of the natural foreseeable progression of that 74 injury, which is essentially what you found in SOPCO 1. Further, that the 1993 total disability and the 1999 death of Jeff SOPCO constituted unforeseeable, substantial, and material changes in the claimant's previous compensable condition, accompanied by permanent injury, permanent disability, and death, whereas claimant had none of these conditions in 1974, 1979, or 1981 when the settlement agreement was last approved. And so we aren't dealing with the same set of facts here. It is so materially different that it would be unjust. The magnitude of what he has built, Jeff SOPCO, has built over 20 years and then lost is what we're trying to compensate for today within the parameters of work comp.
That finding the trial court didn't find, like counsel argued, a new injury.
I don't, you can call it new injury, you can call it progressive injury, you can call it a changing injury. It is not the same injury. I'm not saying you need a new injury to back this theory up, this body of law.
Well, you're saying that the condition as it developed resulted from the original injury.
Absolutely.
And that's how you get to open it up.
Yes, absolutely. And it's causally connected.
Well, there isn't a finding a new injury. That's all. That concerned me.
Well, the whole thing we're talking about, and what's important is the gist of my position is you must first identify and define the injury that we're dealing with. And if, again, that injury is a rigid hole and we're going to cut everything down to fit through it, just like one of those wood choppers, then we are not going to probably prevail. My side is probably not going to prevail. I'm saying that SDCL 62733 enlarges that. It takes that into account. What could it possibly mean that he can increase any payment if the condition of the employee justifies, warrants? What could that mean? Are we going to say any payment except?
Could it mean that when you have the original injury, you have a disability rating of 10%, and as it deteriorates 5 years later, you could increase it because it medical evidence shows that you have a disability of 20%. Isn't that part of what that does?
It could be part of it, but it doesn't say increase the percentage points. It doesn't say in the statute increase the amount of the total previous past award. It says can increase any payment within the minimum and maximum, which means the only payment that's got a minimum and a maximum in our law is the weekly comp rate. That's the payment we're talking about here. So you can increase it, you can award it. And keep in mind, Your Honors, that the recent statutes we're talking about, this July 193 statute, that statute that's cited in our brief says that you can, in fact, increase the weekly comp rates. They have clarified the law now. You can't. It's not a change in the law because you can't be more expensive than the root language, any payment. It's clarifying it. That's our rule. Does it change the root language? If it is, it's a different amendment or a change. If it's the root language that remains intact, the any payment, including. It just said that, including, but not by way of limitation, could have been there. The 6243 comp rate that we base everything on is allowed expressly to be changed. Now, our legislature, we like to give a lot of deference to them, but they haven't thought of every single aspect,
every single possibility that could have occurred.
But what they did do
is they did
grant authority under 62733 to make sure that justice is done.
That's
what we're talking about here.
That's
the position that we're assuming. This was not.
How do we know what the legislature did was for justice to be done?
Well,
we presume it.
I mean, we don't have a congressional record or anything like that to show it. We just have to look at the modifications and the statute and read what is the intent, right?
Yes.
And so you're saying the intent is there to allow you to recover on your theory of this case. And that does justice in your mind.
Well, it does in my mind, and I think objectively. I can't see this would be a just result without this.
You know, the other thing is, as the years have gone by and we've all dealt with workers' compensation, we've seen a lot of changes. The case law that we've set forth in our brief has shown this is not just a matter of contract. If you all
have seen two-page workers' compensation policies,
those contracts are simply saying will follow the law of the state. That's the gist of the two pages. It's not a 20-page auto policy that is a contract. We mandate that company
gives these benefits and takes these risks.
We require it. And they aren't allowed to deviate from it. That's not a contract. And some of the case law has said that
clearly. We're no longer dealing with simply the law of contracts here.
And the case law has matured in those pronouncements as the years have gone by. And so,
excuse me, counsel, you know, the big question is how do you justify the beneficiary death benefits in light of the previous holdings of this court, you know, particularly the Salmon decision?
The Salmon decision totally supports our case,
completely and totally.
The Salmon decision on the death benefit says at the time of injury, they were referring to the initial injury because there was no other injury dealt with in Salmon.
The time of injury governs the rights of the parties except in cases of death. That's what it says.
What's the difference in benefits between your position and the appellant's position?
Approximately
$225 a week.
If this was the same injury, by the way, he'd have been drawing those benefits since 1974 at the lesser rate and would continue to draw them until he runs into some cost of living change, then they would be increased. If that's the theory that they used, he is going to be penalized for having been productive and not drawing those benefits. Now the facts, of course, I'm not claiming he should have drawn them because the facts didn't justify it. He was employable. But we're going to be penalizing people or encouraging people to stay, if we tell them, you remain productive. You remain productive, you build your earning capacity, and if you suffer a loss from this injury,
and the law requires that
employers stay on the risk of this injury, it's clear,
then your benefits should be based on what you've earned and what you've done productively, and as opposed to
just drawing continuous benefits based at the old rate.
I take it there's no difference in benefits than between June 10 and July 1.
No
difference in the amount of benefits. It would be the same.
There was
What's the difference in death benefits if you're able to succeed in your argument?
The argument that I've made, there are cases that do draw a distinction,
and we've cited them, between death benefits and the total disability benefits. Some of them have said you use the last applicable rate, and those are in our brief. Some of them have simply wrestled with the problem and made an equitable adjustment to get to that result.
Because there, you could technically say, well, when the guy died, he wasn't earning any money,
and I don't think that's the intent of the law. What we have in this case is we have a loss that is not a 1974 loss. It's not we didn't have the single man, Jeff Sopko, who died in 1974. We had a man who was in his 40s who died with a wife and three children who had built a 20-year earning capacity. That's the loss that we have. Now, this is not a tort case. But within the parameters of workers' compensation, we're trying to do that kind of justice here. We're trying to fit him in.
It sounds like it's a little flavor of tort as far as for how you get there, but you're saying because of the new earnings, that changes what one is entitled to under the workers' comp.
That's correct. Just
statutorily is what you're saying.
On the facts of this case, with a latent injury
like this one, with an unforeseeable injury and with an injury of this substantial material difference. The law
does not change the comp rates
for anything but what is in substance a new condition that we weren't dealing with. It's substance over form here. That's what we're trying to do.
So what is the amount of maximum death benefits your client can receive?
Her
lifetime, he gets no benefits.
There are no death benefits for the deceased and for his estate. Under our law,
it's his wife and child
who get the benefits. And they get she gets a lifetime. The child gets till age 18, and it's a very small amount, like $50 per week or something.
If you've completed your answer to Justice Saber, your time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nasser. Mr. Schulte, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to Mr. Nasser's arguments, I'd like to initially address one point. This court has consistently ruled that the workers' compensation rights, which vest in individual parties, are purely statutory in nature. They are not of a common law origin. You have to look at the statutes to define the specific rights of the parties. Mr. Nasser has just argued to you that if you examine 62733, that the only conceivable interpretation is any payment must mean any payment and look at the comp rate which exists at the time of a change of condition. I respectfully submit that is not correct. If you look at the statutory language in SDCL 62-733, both in 1974 and as it existed in 1993, it states that you can adjust any payment subject to the maximum or minimum amounts provided for in this title. Now, at the law and the time of an injury truly controls, and the law of 1974 controls, I submit, as we've argued in our court, that you have to look at the maximum or minimum amounts of compensation provided for at the time of the injury in 1974. In order to achieve the result that Mr. Nasser is asking for this court to find, SDCL 62733 would have to explicitly state that you can receive benefits at a maximum or minimum amount of the compensation rate available at the time of a change of condition. The statute does not say that. And in effect, this court would have to add language to that statute, which is simply not there.
How do you explain the language in Salmon where it states, except in case of death?
We've addressed that in our brief, Your Honor, and I guess my response would be twofold to that. Initially, I would urge the court to look at the statutory laws that existed in 1974, which defines, in my opinion, dependency status at the time of injury. Second, the Salmon decision talks about rights and obligations of parties vesting at the time of an injury. If a person would become injured and not die, the obligation due to a work injury, the obligation would be to pay death benefits, or excuse me, would be to pay comp benefits pursuant to whatever they were earning. If that individual would subsequently die, the obligation changes, or death benefits may in fact become an obligation to pay. But that does not alter the fact that the amount of death benefits that you pay, or dependency status for paying those, are still determined at the time of the date of injury. As we've argued in our brief, the obligation may arise, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the benefits that you pay or the amount that you pay will arise as well, because you still have to take the second step of looking at the statutes to determine when you define dependency status. And I believe, again, if you look at the statutes in clear and explicit language, it states that you determine that at the time of injury. In our case, we've also cited a case entitled Anderson versus Hotel Cataract from 1945. Not directly on point, but it dealt with a situation where a man was killed due to an injury while working at the Hotel Cataract. And his father wanted to receive benefits, death benefits, pursuant to the statute in effect at that time. And the court, in just examining the statute in effect at that time, said the requirements of this statute are fulfilled if the person was a dependent at the time of injury. And in that case, the person was. I would just simply respectfully ask the court to look at the plain statutory language. And in addition, I would also urge the court to look at the plain language in both the Salmon case and in the Homestake case, which was recently decided by this court, where it is clearly articulated, especially in the Salmon case, that rights of the parties are vested at the time of injury. In Salmon, there was a knee injury in 1942, which was subsequently settled. The claimant petitioned to reopen in 1945, and the industrial commissioner awarded a level of benefits, medical payments, that were higher than those available at the time of the 1942 injury. And this court, in clear and explicit language, said you cannot do that because this will violate the obligation of contract. And I think that that is especially pertinent in this particular case. In this case, you have a contract entered into between an insurance company and an employer in 1974, which is one contract, and a separate contract, which is also entered into, in effect, between the employer and the state pursuant to our workers' compensation laws, which I consider to be a contract. I believe the rule that we have articulated in Salmon is fair because it is not fair to an employer or an insurer to expect to have to pay compensation rates, which are, in this case, probably five times higher than those available at the time of injury.
But we're not dealing with fairness. We're simply dealing with what the statute says, right?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. That's my first initial argument. But I believe that this puts it in the proper context why we have the statutes as they are now, because you have a clearly defined risk that an insurance company has to pay at a clearly defined time.
Well, how did you get from, I thought I heard that $79.70 at the time of the injury.
Sure.
And now it's at $92.
I should have explained that during the initial argument. When the initial injury occurred in 1974, the maximum compensation rate allowed at that time was $72. Per week, and the maximum compensation rate was paid to Mr. Sopko. A subsequent petition was filed in 1979, and when the parties in 1981 settled that agreement, they settled it at a rate of $92, not $72. The position that we have advanced before the department and the circuit court was that that change of $20 was a mistake, and if you reference the settlement agreement, which is on file, it says specifically Mr. Sopko shall receive for the 50-some days he was off work $92 in comp rate payments, which is the maximum amount available at the time of his injury in 1974. We argued to the department that was a mistake, Your Honor. That's our position.
You argue that it's unfair to the employer and to his insurer if there's increased payments or if these payments go on. But there is a certain trade-off here. Prior to the death, the insurer is making payments to the claimant. And then at the time of his death, there's a certain trade-off under Mr. Nassar's argument that then payments should go to the widow and a dependent if there is one. And if you don't look at like that, if you don't look at it like that, isn't there almost a windfall to the employer and the insurer because they're actually being relieved of a burden upon his death, whereas before they had payments, periodic payments.
I guess, Your Honor, I would not characterize it as a windfall. With all due respect, I would characterize it, and the reason why I made the fairness argument is that it's fair for an insurer or an employer to go into a contract with their eyes open, knowing exactly what amount they have to pay pursuant to the terms of the contract. And under our current law, that's specifically set at the time that a person is injured. And the employer or the insurer can ultimately make plans based upon a calculation that they know to be true and that will exist for their exposure in this case. I think that the essence of
733 gives a lot of discretion, though, does it not, to the department?
As far as determining if there was a change of condition or not, but I would respectfully assert that the discretion as far as adjusting payments is specifically limited in the statute to the maximum or minimum amounts provided for in this title. If you look at the average weekly wage and earnings, where you determine the maximum or minimum amounts provided for in the title, they are specific.
Well, the title means, though, if you reopen it in 84, then I suppose what the title is in 84, that's that's what you got to look at.
I would contend, Your Honor, that if the law in effect at the time of injury controls, these are the laws which outline the parameters of a claim that you can make for workers' compensation benefits, that you have to look at the state of that statute, 62733, and the amounts provided for in the title at the time of injury in 1974.
Why is 33 in existence then? If your hand is tied to the original injury, why did 33, section 33, why was that bad?
Your Honor, I believe it's in existence because it allows for you to either go up or down in your payments if there is a change of condition. If a person gets worse or if they get better, you can adjust the amount of payments. But I believe the case law and the statutes of this court that this court has interpreted are clear, and they indicate that movement can only exist within the confines of what exists at the time of injury or the compensation rate.
Well, in this case, I know your time's up. In this case, 33 provided for someone who wasn't determined to be totally disabled at one time to be determined to be totally disabled because of the change in the condition of work.
Yes,
isn't that what 33 does in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's what, in fact, this court ruled in 1998.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.